Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2021 James Irvine Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As the number of COVID-19 cases continues to rise in California, and even Disneyland is shutting down, I think we could all say we're living in very strange times. Here in the San Joaquin Valley, caution is being exercised all around us. Fresno State, CSU Bakersfield, and UC Merced are going to online classes. Major entertainment events like the Fres Yes Fest have been postponed, and public school districts are limiting activities. So today on our show, we're going to spend some time looking at how the coronavirus is affecting our valley, from healthcare to the economy, from education to the anxiety a pandemic can cause. But before we get to that, we're going to stop and take a deep breath and remind you that the important things in life almost always boil down to connecting with others. Valley Public Radio has partnered with the personal history project StoryCorps and its 2020 mobile tour. Since February 12th, StoryCorps has been in Fresno and Bakersfield, documenting the stories of residents in the San Joaquin Valley. As part of our collaboration, we'll be airing segments over the next year based on some of these recorded conversations. We start our StoryCorps San Joaquin series with Juan Luis Guzman and his sister, Berenice Guzman. The two spoke at the StoryCorps Airstream in downtown Fresno. Juan is a poet and professor in Fresno, and Berenice is a teacher in Dinuba. They started by talking about home. It's something Juan asked his students to write about that day, and it got him wondering where home was for the two of them.
I know, it's weird. Like, we never actually lived in Mexico, but I always felt like we kind of I grew up in Mexico, you know, even though we visited maybe, like, twice a year.
Me too. And it is, like, it's a little strange because we didn't grow up there. Mm-hmm. I was born there, right. You know, but I did come here, you know, 2 months mm-hmm. of age. But, yeah, I can totally understand what you mean by home.
And you're the only one in our family that was born in Mexico.
I know. I used to take pride in that when I was young. I still do. I do take pride in that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it shaped your experience differently than ours? Because you had to go through naturalization.
I did. You know, it kind of provided me an insight as to, like, the process of the naturalization process. Mm-hmm. And I experienced it at the age of 16. So to me, it was nerve-wracking and scary. But I'm glad I did it. And I'm glad I kind of have that experience because, you know, teaching in Dinuba, where I teach, mm-hmm. Some of my students will ask me questions and then I can be, okay, I can relate to them or they can relate to me. You know, when the whole dreamer thing came rising and out of the shadows, I thought that could have easily been me. Mm-hmm. If my parents wouldn't have taken the time to get me my, you know, green card or my alien resident card, mm-hmm. we call it a mica.
The mica.
Then that could have potentially been me. Mm-hmm. And it would have just shaped, my life would have been so much different. So I have a lot of, you know, gratitude to our parents that did that, mm-hmm. that took the time to say, hey, we need to get this girl her mica and get her. Because my mom, according to the story, mm-hmm. my mom said they were in line to cross the border and they ran into one of our aunts, Tia Maria, who passed away, you know, en paz descanse. And she said, my mom's like, we've been here since, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning and we need this paperwork and this is missing. And my tia's like, give her to me. I'll take her. I'll smuggle her in. And I don't think she was joking. I think she was serious. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, I could have easily, my life could have just changed so easily. It could have been so much different. So I have a couple questions. One question I want to ask you is, who has been the kindest to you?
I can't pinpoint like one specific person. But the people that do come to mind are almost always teachers.
That's what I was thinking, too. I think both of us went into that profession, you know, education, because our first our first people that we knew that were professionals that had been to college mm-hmm. were teachers. Mm-hmm. Growing up in Lavadio, like you said, my mom and dad didn't go to college. Our neighbors didn't go to college. We didn't know anybody who had been to college.
Right.
The only people we knew and we interacted with on a daily basis were our teachers.
Mm-hmm. After our sister died,
mm-hmm.
And we were young still, I think even then a lot of teachers were kind, you know, because they knew that we had potential, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I've always loved school.
Right.
You know, after Isa died, that teachers, I think even before that, they wanted to help me. But after that, they knew that I needed their help. You know what I mean? Like,
I think they saw the potential in us.
So I'll talk about, like, Mrs. Areola.
Right.
You know, in fourth grade, when Isa died, she took me to the back of the room and she gave me a Robert Frost poem, Stopping by Woods on Snowy Evening. And she read it to me and we read it together. And that was like my first introduction to poetry. And I was like raw after Isa died. And I didn't have anyone to talk to,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's when I started writing. And like she put me on that path.
And you were only in fourth grade.
And I was in fourth grade.
Like Robert Frost is a fourth grader.
Yeah, who reads Robert Frost in fourth grade, you know.
Yeah.
And then I wrote like an essay on Martin Luther King Jr. and it won like a Rotary
mm-hmm.
contest. And I was like, okay, I guess this is like something that I could do. So I do think like because that teacher was kind to me, that's why I am where I am today.
I'm glad I did this.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming and doing this.
It was different than just...
And we didn't really cry.
No, I know. I only used one tissue.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I could be here for another hour, though.
I know. Can we steal someone else's spot? Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And I love you.
Love you too, brother.
We also wanted to let you know that the StoryCorps San Joaquin listening event, scheduled for March 19th, has been canceled and will be rescheduled to a new date later in the year. You're listening to a catchy public service announcement from Vietnam's Ministry of Health regarding the coronavirus and how to fight it. It's one of many songs you can find on YouTube these days, reminding people to take some basic steps, from hand washing to avoiding large crowds, to stay healthy. A few cases of COVID-19 have already been confirmed here in the San Joaquin Valley, all travel-related. And health officials are also monitoring dozens of residents for symptoms. To find out more about how the disease is affecting our healthcare system, higher education, and the economy, I spoke to Dr. Ray Svora with the Fresno County Department of Public Health, Dr. Terrence McGovern with Madera Community Hospital, Charles Nyes, Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs at UC Merced, and Nayakundi Micheka, Assistant Professor of Economics at CSU Bakersfield. Dr. McGovern, I'd like to start with you. Sure. You treated the Valley's first patient with COVID-19. Tell us about the protocol.
Right. Yeah. So we're pretty fortunate, to be honest, where our situation was that we were notified by the Madera County Department of Public Health that we had a patient that was under investigation for COVID-19 that was on a previous cruise ship, that there is concern for COVID-19. So we were kind of pre-notified that they're going to be coming in. So we're able to coordinate with public health and the patient and our emergency room, where we're able to meet them in the parking lot, actually get them both masked before they even came into the ER. We had already kind of come up with a plan where they'd go into separate entrance to the ER, where they wouldn't be mixing in with the normal kind of ER department in terms of patient load. So they never went in the waiting room. They never went through the kind of common areas of the ER. They went directly into their room, went into isolation, and they stayed there pretty much the whole time that they were here in the hospital. So they did very well throughout the time. They're tested. The swabs went to Tulare and was tested, and one of them was tested positive, one was negative. They're both doing so well, they're able to go home and just under a home quarantine, still under surveillance with public health. But, you know, otherwise it went very smoothly on our part. But we're fortunate that it was kind of pre-notified for us. So it made it a little bit easier on us than what we're expecting our first case to be.
Exactly. Dr. Borja, there's been a lot of conversation about the lack of tests available. At this point, how easy is it to get authorization from the CDC to test, and how long does it take to get the results?
Okay, yeah, great question. This is moving rather quickly, and as of this week, the CDC has a network of public health laboratories that are doing the testing. As you can imagine, as the numbers go up, these laboratories have become somewhat impacted. So we're still working through the best processes to get people tested. Having said that, there's some good news in this, in the sense that several private labs and some university and academic centers have also offered their own testing platforms, so that clinicians and patients now have different options for getting this testing done in patients who qualify. I do have to add, though, that not everyone who desires a test should really be encouraged to go ahead and get one. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, misinformation and understandably anxiety about whether you need to be tested or not. And I think that for the purposes of our Central California communities here, because we're not seeing communities spread, your pretest probability, your probability of actually having COVID without having a history of travel or close contact with someone else who has this illness is actually still very low. So chances are you still probably just have an ordinary common cold kind of virus or even influenza. Those are still much more likely than the ordinary person having the COVID infection. And so we're still encouraging people to, you know, if you're at all sick, go ahead and stay home and see if it just gets better for a couple of days. Do not rush into a medical facility and ask for a test, because that's going to keep people that actually need the testing done from getting that done efficiently. And we're just trying to be reasonable about how this testing proceeds.
That's great advice. Vice Chancellor Neese, I'd like to turn the conversation to you. You know, we're seeing schools and universities throughout California taking very different approaches to mitigate the spread of COVID-19, you know, obviously in response to what's happening in their communities. You know, we don't have any, at the time of this conversation, there haven't been any reported cases in Merced County. I'm just curious if you could talk to us about the kind of coordination that's taking place right now between UC Merced and health officials, and what goes into the development of your response as a campus?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think part of what we have done as a campus is looking at the health and safety of the campus community as well as the surrounding community, knowing that the majority of our students that attend the University of California in Merced do not come from the area. And so they may be going home, visiting home. And so how can we think about the ways that we can help mitigate the spread of the virus? And so that's where we made the decision to move our instruction online as best as we can for particularly our large lecture classes, just to begin to find ways that we can decrease some of the density on campus and therefore maybe mitigate some of that spread that may occur. And so we took a preemptive move instead of waiting until there was an identified case. But we're continuing then to coordinate, particularly working daily with the County Office of Health as well as with the local hospital to make sure that all of our protocols are in place. If we do have someone that is particularly under investigation for having been exposed to someone with COVID, we've got all those protocols in place so that we can coordinate a response, much like you heard described in Madera. We want to make sure that those individuals show up in the parking lot, they're met by health representatives there, and then taken into an isolated place where the samples can be collected and we can and test people without exposing more people potentially to the virus. So coordinating all of these efforts means that we are in constant and regular communication. But for us at the university, really thinking about the broader community and how do we work collectively to mitigate the potential spread of the virus was what led us to making the decision to move our course instruction online. We have not closed the university. The university is still open. Our students are still living on campus. Our offices are still operating. But we're just trying to decrease the density around number of people that might be together in one space.
Which seems to be a strategy many institutions and communities are deploying at this point. Professor Macheka, we've seen incredible volatility in the stock market. Obviously, this pandemic is deeply impacting the economy. I'd love to get your thoughts about what we could anticipate seeing to the local economy. What's going to happen here in the Central Valley?
So looking at what has happened, earlier this week, we saw an increase in supply of petroleum or oil from Saudi Arabia, which has ultimately led to a reduction in the price of gas. And what we're also seeing with COVID-19 is there's been a reduction in demand for people to go to places. So there's a reduction in driving. There's also a reduction in the airline industry and a reduction in the hotel industry. So also following up with some of the events that have been taking place, we've seen, you know, the NBA, the NHL, the MLB, and some of the local events here being cancelled due to, you know, the potential spread of this disease. So in some sectors, we're seeing a reduction in demand, the ones I just mentioned. But then on the other hand, consumers are now spending more money at grocery stores. Folks are buying, you know, they're buying food, they're buying oranges and all these vitamin C products and all these cleaning supplies. And this has seen, you know, an increase in demand for workers within the service sector. And then very, very interestingly, some folks are probably staying home. And if this happens, you know, especially with these large organizations, you're going to see a situation where instead of having 100 people driving to work, you have 100 people staying at home, and these are 100 people who now have to work from home, and that could also ultimately see an increase in demand for electricity. You know, we're not in a very cold area, but in the east where things are, you know, different, you could see a rising demand for electricity, as well as other things such as demand for streaming services and other delivery options like Uber Eats and Instacart. So there are very, very many things happening. There's some folks who will gain and lose, but there's some, you know, changes that will happen within the short run, and we just don't know how long this will take.
Dr. McGovern, you know, we're seeing statewide a shift from a containment strategy to community mitigation. Can you explain what that difference is and why health departments are suggesting taking that approach?
Yeah, you know, I think it's initially, I think COVID-19 is here. You know, I don't think there's any getting around it at this point that it is here in California, it's here in the U.S., and it's not going anywhere quickly. So one of the things that you'll hear people talk about is flattening the epidemiologic curve with this, where we need to slow the spread of the virus as slowly as we can. We expect it to spread. What we don't want to see is this exponential rise in cases, because honestly, it's going to be difficult for the healthcare industry to keep up with it in terms of resource utilization, just physical space in hospitals, testing, supplies, staff, all these things are going to be really stretched to the breaking point, to be honest. So I think that's a lot of the reason why we're kind of changing containment to trying to just slow down the spread of this.
Dr. Vorha, now that it is a pandemic, what are your predictions about what comes next?
So, yeah, great question. I mean, you know, things, I think the federal authorities have certainly made this prediction, and I definitely concur, that things are going to get worse. We are going to see more cases. We're going to see that community spread affecting our communities. You know, depending on how we respond to that here locally and as a state and country, I think that we have a real chance to make sure that we mitigate that spread. And like Dr. McGovern said, flatten that curve and make sure that we can at least delay the peak and decrease the overall numbers just with all of the mitigation strategies that are now being put into place.
So Vice Chancellor Nies, this has been a really scary time for people. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And I'm wondering, what are you hearing from the campus community?
Yeah, I think that the fear is out there. And I think part of the struggle, right, as we talk about one of the ways to mitigate this is to create social distancing. But at the same time, people are wanting connections with people because of the fear and uncertainty that this has created. And so for us, it's trying to find that balance about creating spaces for people to still feel that they are in a community, but also being mindful of how do we make some healthy choices within those spaces. And so I think that's been a big part of our effort as we've moved forward is talking about social distancing in a way that doesn't lead to this complete and total emotional isolation. And then that anxiety then builds up in ways that students are struggling to manage, and not just students, but I think the community in general. We're hearing it from staff who are wondering, should I come into work? And is it safer for me to stay at home and telecommuting? And so all of that is part of the conversations we're obviously having with both our staff and faculty and students is what are those options and how do you make choices for yourself that feel safe for yourself? And so the more that we can come up with the breadth of options for them to make those decisions and make those choices is what we're really trying to come up with and develop. Even our athletic teams, we haven't canceled all of our athletic sports. We are doing no fan athletic events, but we still want them to be able to participate. But yet some of them are saying, well, do I really want to drive down to LA and compete in an athletic event down in LA where there is a lot more cases? Isn't it not safer for me to stay in Merced where right now there isn't any known cases that have been reported? So we're trying to give students and faculty and staff that balance to make those choices that they feel most comfortable with, but also being mindful of how do you create a sense of community while you're also trying to support social distancing. So that's that balancing act that I think all of our communities, not just on our campus, but all of our communities are going to need to balance as we move forward.
Professor Macheka, if we reach a point in the Valley where, let's say, movie theaters are closing down, gyms, some restaurants perhaps, I'm just wondering, what is the long-term, potential long-term impact, particularly for locally owned businesses?
So going forward, I mean, so it just depends whether that will actually happen and for how long that will happen. Because in the end, there's, you know, if we curtail spending in one area, there's probably going to be an increase in spending in another area. So, you know, if you close down movie theaters and folks are choosing to stay home, then you might see, you know, folks probably need to still get a little bit entertained, so they might spend money on streaming services, or, you know, they might find ways to go and you know, enjoy themselves and probably go to the gym and spend their leisure time at different areas. So it's a very interesting thing right now, but I know that, you know, once it gets over, we'll definitely bounce back, and things will bounce back, the economy will bounce back to where it should be.
Right. Dr. Vorhov, what about vulnerable populations like people experiencing homelessness? What can health officials do to protect that community?
Well, we're focusing on really all the sectors that that make up our community, the healthcare sector, our community-based organizations that work with elders and with those experiencing homelessness. And we're really just trying to get them prepared for what's to come. I think that each organization and each agency and really at the individual level, everyone's going to have a little bit different situation with what they need to do, just depending on where they live, who they interact with, where they work. But really, it's just all about trying to minimize the spread of germs. Obviously, that's a challenge for those that experience homelessness, and we want to get them the resources that they need. Right now, it's really just all about education because we haven't seen any COVID infection in that population. But we do want to be prepared for that contingency and make sure that our shelters, that our organizations that work with the homeless, that those who are working on the front lines in the pre-hospital and in the emergency departments are all prepared to look for, diagnose, and then ultimately protect themselves and protect our patients from this COVID infection whenever it is seen in that community.
So speaking about the spread of germs, Dr. McGovern, do you think the precautions being taken to prevent the spread of COVID-19 will also slow the spread of flu this season?
Absolutely. I think, you know, they kind of go hand in hand in some regard to how they get spread. And I think all these steps that we're taking for preventing the spread of COVID-19 will definitely help kind of curb the effects of the flu as well this year, for sure.
So Vice Chancellor Nies, I'd like to come back to you and talk about what's happening with students. I would imagine you have students studying abroad. What's going on with them?
Yeah, I think we're working with those students. Having programs with students in Italy as well as South Korea, which are level 3 countries. Those students have returned to the United States. We're looking at different ways that they can continue to move forward with their academic progress. It's hard to come back to a university in the middle of a semester and just think that you can pick up and earn units or credits for those coursework. And so fortunately, we're part of the University of California, and so we're tapping into the structure of the University of California and potentially having some of those students take quarter classes at some of the other UC campuses that are on the quarter so that they could participate in a spring course or two so that they can still move forward with their degrees. But we are reaching out to our other students who are studying abroad in other countries that are not at a level 3 with the decision to to mitigate flights coming from Europe. We have a lot of students that are in Europe, and just if they're wanting to come home, well, right now that's not an option for them. And so how do we support them long distance and make sure that we're communicating with them to know that we are being mindful that they're overseas and that this might be a scary time for them to not be with family and not be back in a country that they're familiar with. And so all of that is part of the way that we're continuing to try to find that support that we can provide those students even long distance. And then even on campus, as you talked about, you know, people and their work and making decisions, if some of our students who are working, if that office shuts down or that business operation shuts down, they're hourly employees. And so they're not going to work and they're not making pay. And so we're constantly being mindful of how we support students that might find themselves in that situation as well. And what resources might we have from a food bank resource and food pantry resource, as well as other emergency funds that they might need, because the business that they work at isn't opening and they can't make that hourly pay to pay their rent and to buy food. And all of that becomes really important for us to make sure that we're supporting our students as they go through all of these different transitions that are happening.
And really quickly, what about international students who are studying it?
Yeah, we have a fair number of international students, particularly in our graduate programs, that are from other countries. And so I'm reaching out to them. We've put together different resource guides on how you think about and manage the emotional impact that this might have on you as you're looking at what might be happening in your native country as you're over here in the United States, knowing that you can't travel back there or be with family that are back there. And so trying to find different ways to support them, different support groups that we're actually able to pull together so that they can have conversations with one another about what this feels like for them. So all of that is part of the way that we're considering how to support them during this time of uncertainty.
So Dr. Vorha, tell us a little bit more about COVID-19 in general. How does it differ from a flu in terms of how it manifests in the body?
Sure. Well, we're still learning more about exactly what the differences are. But for the most part, it really does seem to look and feel like an upper respiratory infection or what we call influenza-like illness, in that most patients will develop fevers. Then they'll develop maybe body aches, muscle pains. And then invariably, they develop some element of respiratory complaint. Most of the time, that's cough. Sometimes they feel short of breath. Sometimes they have even the sniffles or sneezing, et cetera. And that's really important because that's when the person is most contagious, is when they actually are spreading, we say shedding viral particles, and just spreading their secretions and droplets if they're not masked up. So that's what most people experience. And just like with influenza and the common cold, most people are going to recover in 2 days, 3 days, and they'll just bounce right back, especially if they have time to rest, heal their bodies. Their immune system will kick in if they pay attention to their hydration and their nutrition and take fever medicine. So all things that can be done at home, even without coming into an emergency department or a medical clinic, they can get through this on their own. And that's like 80 to 90% of patients will just recover spontaneously on their own. A few patients, a minority of patients, and again, this is very parallel to influenza, will go on to have complications that will need medical attention. And we know that these patients tend to be older. They may have medical illnesses, medical complex issues like lung disease or sometimes cardiovascular disease. Obviously, if they have a history of cancer or malignancy and they're on chemotherapy and their immune system is weak, those are the patients that we expect will have the complications from COVID, just like they already have complications from things like influenza or even ordinary pneumonia. And then those patients can get more what we call lower respiratory infections, including things like bronchitis and pneumonia, and even be so sick that they need to have ventilation machines and things like that. But again, that's a very small number of patients, certainly a number that we're keeping a very careful eye on around the world to see how different countries and different cities are experiencing this. But on the whole, that's what seems to occur, is that young, otherwise healthy people may not even realize that they have the infection, or if they do, they will be out of school or out of work for just a couple of days and then be right back. And our older, more fragile patients will have a little bit of a rougher course.
Well, thank you all for being with us and for helping to get some good information out to the community. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As COVID-19 continues to spread, we hear a lot about how to protect your physical health. But what about your mental and emotional health? I spoke with Dr. Jasmine Singh, resident in the UCSF Fresno Department of Psychiatry, about how to manage coronavirus panic. I'd like to start with a confession, I suppose. So I wasn't taking COVID-19 all that seriously until last weekend when I went to Target. And, you know, I was there to get a shower curtain liner and shelves were empty. People were walking around with face masks. They were wiping down their carts. And I found myself buying toilet paper and non-perishable food that I did not need. Was I being completely irrational?
No. So first of all, thank you for having me, Kathleen. Appreciate it. No, I don't think you were being irrational. I think you were having a very normal and expected response to everything you've been seeing and hearing. The fear about coronavirus has totally escalated. Each and every day, we get another level of, you know, panic and fear that we hear, oh, this is canceled and this is happening and the NBA and, you know, everyone seems to be taking these precautions. And I think that's what we need to remember, that these are precautions. I think the public health department is looking at Italy and China and seeing how the coronavirus affected them and trying to not have us in the United States reach that point of quarantine and the hospitals overrun. And that's why I believe we're having these precautions. Now, when does precaution lead to panic and anxiety that we can't control? That is, of course, an individual question for each of us. Now, I find it healthy that, you know, you prepared and you saw what the situation was out around where you live in your Target. But if you continue to perseverate on this and you weren't able to do your work or take care of yourself, your family, that would be very detrimental to your well-being.
Well, and that brings me to my next question. You know, when is that moment when a healthy fear turns into anxiety or panic? What should people be looking out for?
They should be looking out for essentially being mindful of their thoughts. So if they keep thinking about coronavirus throughout the day and aren't able to function, aren't able to go to work, are thinking about death, that's, you know, a symptom of panic disorder. You're thinking that, oh my gosh, I'm going to die. Or you start to have psychiatric symptoms like heart racing or feeling worried all the time. I think when you start to have those symptoms, that's when you have to think, okay, what's happening here? What am I doing? And really get back to the facts. I think in almost all situations, the response to a highly emotional situation is to check the facts. And so I think we need to remember that although this virus is rapidly spreading at an exponential rate, it is not as deadly as we may think it is. So the rates have been published by the World Health Organization, about 2 to 3.6% is the rate of death, largely affecting certain populations, the chronically ill, elderly, the immunosuppressed. So I think we need to remember that's the fact, and where are we in that scenario?
So to what extent is the media contributing to this anxiety?
I believe highly. We are so inundated with our media nowadays. Through social media, Facebook, Instagram, we are always learning about what's happening to people we know and around the world. Information passes very readily nowadays. So things that are happening and we're finding out about them rather quickly, and sometimes they may not even be fact-checked. So it puts us in this hypervigilant state that I talk about. And if someone who has been through something difficult, they could probably understand what that feels like. You feel like everything is a danger. You feel that there's a threat everywhere. And you aren't able to think clearly. So we want to remain in a rational problem-solving mode. And if we are hypervigilant or highly anxious, we can't be in that problem-solving mode. So that's when I think we need to cut back our use of media, get the news we need, and then just kind of quarantine ourselves from the media a bit.
So this situation is moving so fast, and there's so much that we don't know about how the pandemic is going to unfold. So how do you advise managing that level of uncertainty?
Acceptance. So I think an acceptance of that this is an uncertain situation. We don't know all the facts. We don't know if the person we are meeting has been exposed to coronavirus or not. Are they a carrier? We don't have that information. So, but if you think about it, largely in life, we don't have such information about impending issues or health problems that are coming our way. So this attitude of acceptance of the uncertainty, I think, will be very beneficial to people. We cannot control everything that happens in life. That's just the nature of living, and it's a human condition. So essentially, acceptance of that will be the way to manage the uncertainty surrounding coronavirus.
And what other recommendations do you have for maintaining good mental health as this situation continues to unfold?
So those who have struggled with mental health in the past will know the value of going to therapy, taking their medication, and remaining up to date on those issues. Now is not the time to stop those self-care situations and stop mental health care. It's not the time. But if you feel that you need that and you've never had it before, feel free to reach out to your regular doctor, your primary care physician, or even find a psychiatrist or therapist that can help you.
So there have been a lot of people, including elected officials, that have blamed this pandemic on China or Europe, which is fueling xenophobia and racism. How do we combat that?
Yes, it's tragic, actually. We must remember not to place blame. This is a virus. It is naturally occurring. No one, you know, made it and, you know, tried to hurt us. This is something that has just happened. And if we accept that this has just happened and accept that no one is responsible, that will be a much more calming and rational place to be than blaming any certain individual, any particular race. There have been many media reports of locally, there has been an uptick in racism towards certain groups of people who, you know, could be linked potentially to areas that are highly affected by the coronavirus. And I don't think that's helpful. How is that helping us? How is that effective? So I find that don't blame people. Just accept that this is a virus and it's affecting everyone all over the globe equally.
Any last minute tips or advice that you would offer the public? What should we be doing to care for ourselves?
So continue to be a healthy person as much as you can. Sleep, healthy eating, and I would definitely agree with the CDC's recommendations. Hand washing, of course, for 20 seconds. And they are promoting social distancing. I'm sure you've read about that. But avoiding large gatherings, especially if you're someone who is in the population that is at higher risk of mortality from coronavirus. So avoiding large groups of people. And I think there another recommendation is staying 2 meters away. So almost as far as we are from each other. And so definitely the CDC is an excellent source. They're working very hard around the clock to help the American people. And definitely be mindful of where your mind and thoughts are going. Are you overly, you know, scared about this? Do you need to talk to someone? How are you going to manage this? Because you need to be in the best place possible for yourself and your family and your other loved ones.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. With all of this talk about COVID-19, maybe it's time to practice some social distancing and read a good book. Central Valley author Anne DeVigo's latest book is set in 1978 Bakersfield, at a time when some powerful men in the city used their positions to take advantage of young men and even boys. These men in power were attorneys, judges, and executives in the community. They're known by some as the Lords of Bakersfield. And one chilling trend, a number of them were murdered by the young men they abused. FM89's Laura Satsui interviewed DeVigo about her book, Bakersfield Boys Club, which is inspired by the Lords of Bakersfield and the murders that followed.
Anne DeVigo, thanks for being with us. Before we talk about your book, I want to start with your background. So you studied English and journalism at Fresno State, and then after graduating, you reported on a few high-profile crimes around the Valley, like the Chowchilla school bus kidnapping for the Madera Tribune, and then you also covered one of the earliest murders relating to the Lords of Bakersfield, which, for those unfamiliar, the Lords of Bakersfield were a group of men in power who basically used it to abuse others in Kern County. It all culminated in sex trafficking, cover-ups, and even a few murders in the 80s. So as a reporter, Anne, you covered the murder trial of Tommy Tarver, who was a beauty salon owner, but he also was sexually abusing 13-year-old Robert Mistriel. Robert was a suspect in that case, and he was found guilty of burglarizing the salon, but he was acquitted of the actual murder. But over the years, he did end up entangled with the Lords of Bakersfield. But what about that first trial that you covered? Could you not just get out of your head over the years?
Well, Robert never appeared in court. Robert was an early suspect in that murder. He had been at the house that evening, the house where the man was murdered. Another adult was actually arrested for that murder, but never convicted. But Robert himself, who at the time was 13 years old and had been sexually abused by the dead man, was sent to a boys' home. And he was there for a few months, and then he was released, and his mother continued to put him out as a prostitute, and he continued to be abused by men in the community. So this is a boy of 13 that's kind of at the mercy of powerful men in Bakersfield.
Yeah, and your book is inspired by those events. Why did you want to write sort of like a fictionalized, a book inspired by the events and maybe not necessarily something based on them?
Well, there were a series of murders that happened. They called them the Lords of Bakersfield murders, and many of them involved underage and vulnerable boys like Robert Mistriel, who had no stable family life. And these boys, were routinely abused by powerful men in Bakersfield. And so I wanted to pull that together, not just Robert's case, but the cases of other boys who were also abused. Several of them killed their abusers and went to prison. So it ruined the lives of boys, not just Robert, for many years to come. And I just felt that I wanted to find a way to pull all those cases together. They occurred over many years. And so I created a widow struggling to make ends meet who has a 14-year-old boy who gets drawn into this culture of abuse.
The widow Suzanne is in your book, and her teen son Danny, sort of in a similar way to how that first murder of a salon owner, he happens to be, in your book, the boy Danny happens to be at the party one night, and the next morning the owner of the house who threw the party is found dead, and sort of sets off all of these different events. And I think, as you mentioned, many of those boys who were abused in Bakersfield years ago killed their abusers. Robert Mistriel he committed murder himself with a friend, and he served 38 years in prison. And so your book, taking a look at this mother and son who were abused by people in power, I feel like it's kind of interesting because you get to know these characters and you really feel and empathize with them. But then when you look back at real life, it's like, those victims also committed crimes as well and were convicted for them. And so I guess in a way, is your book asking us to empathize more with those victims?
I think we do empathize with those victims. Who knows what would have happened if those boys had not been abused, if someone had taken care of them? Robert Mistriel had no viable family. What if he'd had a foster mother or a foster father to take care of him? But that didn't happen in the Bakersfield community back in those days. So, I did feel a lot of empathy for those boys. Clearly, they did bad things. Clearly, Robert Mistriel and his co-defendant did bad things. Another boy, who was abused and held prisoner by one of these men, did a bad thing. But I just can't help but feel that if someone had intervened, or if local authorities had intervened, that there would have been a different outcome.
Right. And I think that's part of what makes the whole Lords of Bakersfield system so, you know, so horrifying, is that people in power were involved in sort of this whole ring of abuse and sex trafficking. And I want to point out, too, that the mother in your story is not like Robert Mistral's mother in real life. Did you ever speak to that woman?
No, I did not. I never saw her. Mm. And you're right that that people in the community, you know, people in positions of authority, not only did they, you know, they're the abusers, but they're a kind of a group of people around those people that didn't take responsibility.
Right, there were cover-ups.
In the court transcript, in the sentencing hearing for Robert Mistral, his probation officer told Robert that he should, quote unquote, stop using people. Mm. You know, here was the boy who had been abused by powerful people in the community, and she's scolding him, you know, for using people. So even his probation officer was not stepping up to see that he was protected, or that the men who were abusing him were charged.
The Bakersfield Californian ended up reporting out a really long series on what happened, including with the Lords of Bakersfield and even to Robert Mistral, you know, years ago. When you read that, did you feel like you had any closure from covering that first trial, you know, back in the 70s?
Yes, I did. I thought Robert Price did an amazing job on that series. And it actually won a major journalism award for his work. And I did feel at last somebody was actually saying what was true about that. At the time that I covered that trial, you know, I never met Robert. He was kind of this shadowy figure behind the court proceedings.
And Robert, the 13-year-old, not
testify.
Robert,
and
the
that
author.
Was something that I always thought was strange at the time, was that he was there that night, but he was never called to testify. And so, you know, all those things ate at me over the years. I thought about him all those years. And so seeing Bob Price's story in the Californian, actually, it kind of stirred me up to start on this book.
And so for those who have read Robert Price's series in the Bakersfield Californian, or maybe those who just are familiar with the Lords of Bakersfield, what do you think they would get out of reading your book as well?
Well, I think one of the things is that Bakersfield back in those years was quite an isolated place. And, you know, the I-5 had not been completed yet, which seems crazy to us now. It was 2 hours to Fresno, and it was a long drive over the mountains down into L.A. These were powerful men in an isolated place. And I think that was part of the reason why the abuse went on for a long time. But when you look now at the cases of sexual abuse of young people in the Catholic Church, the Epstein case, the Weinstein case, you see that they are also powerful people in which the young people and the abusers are in kind of an isolated situation. In the Catholic Church, where the priests were men of power in that community, and in the movie industry, where people like Weinstein are pretty much untouchable, the people are, one, very powerful, and two, the victims feel as though they're isolated. And I think that was the case in Bakersfield as well.
Yeah, I think that shows, you're right, there's a lot of trends in sort of how people who choose to abuse their power go about doing it and get away with it. But, you know, as we've seen, in some cases, aren't getting away with it anymore. Anne, thank you so much for speaking with us. We've been talking to journalist and author Anne DeVigo. Her latest book is The Bakersfield Boys Club. She'll actually be signing copies at the Fresno Barnes & Noble the afternoon of Sunday, March 22nd. So you can meet her there and buy her book. Anne, thank you so much for your time.
And thank you very much, Laura. It was great to talk to you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Laura Satsui, and Madi Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2021 James Irvine Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.